From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 23rd day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news, USDA says it and the Obama administration are going to do as much as possible to make ethanol a national industry. The Secretary of Ag even hinted US EPA would opt for E15 later this year. And IEA predicts world demand for oil will be up more than suspected through 2015. Output is expected to grow along with demand. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. In the second half hour of our program today on the Farming World, that's available on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with Rocky Lundy of the Mint Industry Research Council. You can get a jump on that by visiting their website at usmintindustry.org. And it all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Lernard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Lernard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
On this Wednesday afternoon, futures in Chicago finished like this. For the soft red winter wheat nearby harvest month July contract, a 462 1/4 settlement price, up a penny and a half. September unchanged at 475 3/4, and December wheat at 502 1/2 in Chicago, down 1 3/4. The hard red July in Kansas City at $4.95, a penny higher. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, 346 1/2, a settlement price down 5 1/2 cents. September 355 1/2, 5 1/2 lower. December 365 1/2, down 6 1/2, and the March 378 1/2, down 6 1/2 cents. May futures 387 3/4, down 6. Soy complex, soybeans 958 for the July futures, 7 1/2 cents lower. August at 946, down 12. September at 930, 12 1/2 lower. November beans at 923 1/2, down 12 1/2. January 932 3/4, down 12. And 1/4. July bean meal at 289.30, down 140. Oil at 37.59, down 34. June cattle $90.25, a nickel lower. The live cattle August at 111.90, 7 1/2 cents higher. And July lean hogs at 81.45, down 50 cents for the day. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Futures in the crude oil at $76.37 a barrel, down $1.48. Fuel ethanol at $1.56 1/8, down $0.01 1/8. Natural gas at $4.78 2/10, 2 6/10 higher. July heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.06 1/8, down 4 4/10. And the gold futures June contract down $5.80 today at $1,234.10. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now just about 22 points higher at 10,318. And the U.S. dollar at 85.76 is down 0.34 on the afternoon. The weather forecast says another moderate risk of severe weather is in place for the Midwest today. Northern Illinois to central and northern Ohio and southern Michigan are under pressure for hail, damaging wind, and a possible tornado or two. A slight risk of severe weather encompasses the remainder of the region. Restricted rainfall will continue from Missouri through southern Illinois to Kentucky over the next week to 10 days. Totally dry weather not expected, but net drying can be anticipated. Temperatures will continue quite warm today with highs in the 80s and the 90s. Some cooling will occur Thursday into Friday, but it won't be very significant. Warming again during the weekend, and then a more significant bout of cooling and lower humidity will occur next week. Thunderstorms in the Midwest today and Thursday will be followed by some Friday and Sunday. Locally heavy amounts of rain will result in the greatest amount in the northern part of the Midwest. We'll have a more complete, detailed look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk directly with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
On this Wednesday afternoon, you're listening to the Closing Mark Report. Time to talk about the agricultural futures markets. Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services is on the phone line from Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Paul. Oop, Paul was there. Should be there. Don't see any reason he shouldn't be there. Let me see. Where is he? How about that, Paul? Are you with me now?
Hi, Todd.
How are you today?
Good.
Well, tell me about this marketplace. We lost a nickel. Is that just marching with time and taking away some of the gains that have been happening over the last 3 or 4 weeks?
Well, last Friday and Sunday night and Monday was the opportunity to unload the bins if you hadn't done it. And the market did see some sell-off and profit-taking from cash movement. And then today and overnight, we did get this forecast of cooler, drier weather in the Midwest and maybe some very light rain in the Delta and the Southeast. And, of course, some of the forecasters are predicting this trend to continue for the near term. The market also took news of housing starts on the nose, and they saw probably a very poor job of the Canadian Statistical Service of issuing their planted reports as of June the 1st with a very large oilseeds crop and somewhat of a mixed sign in the wheat area. The market is seeing some deflation with crude oil, gold, silver, and, you know, a political plate that kind of cracked in about three places in Washington. So we saw this sell-off, and there's no friends in Chicago right now because the cooler, drier weather would help basically give people opportunity to get their crop looking a little better, they hope.
Yeah, that for the corn. And then on the soybean size oil seeds, you're talking about canola plantings in pretty good size in Canada?
Yes. And, you know, it's the trend that we're finding everywhere in the world that farmers are planning for the most gross dollars. And, of course, they've learned that trick as well in Canada and planted for oil seeds because of the price levels. The other big factor is you know, there will be the debate of the June planting intentions report here in the U.S. There is a feeling that maybe the crop ratings go down another week here. But the farmer, you know, just plain and simple, is holding too much corn. And as a result of that, you know, the corn was weak as well as the soybean market.
If you look out past this current point and through August into September, October, and into that first quarter of the next fiscal marketing year, do you have a pulse on what you think the export market might look like for corn and beans?
Well, that's a good question. As far as the export market is concerned, you know, we do anticipate, you know, some of the crop levels and crop supplies around the world to be slightly smaller. And as a result of that, that should make U.S. grains very competitive. The report card is very important because we have to watch the monsoons in India. We also have to see the weather forecast in China. And the Chinese are going through some very warm temperatures at the present time. And all those areas are very populous, as well as they do have big checkbooks that can come into the marketplace.
Did you see, and I heard this in the newscast that we'll hear in just a bit from Dave Dickey, that Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, sort of hinted that E15 might be in the wings at least for some vehicles in the United States?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? And we also, he mentioned that it'd be wonderful if we had a ethanol plant in every state in the United States for political reasons as well. the big factor here is that it's a positive statement, and we need this kind of demand to give the stability in the grain markets, because the government is encouraging full production as much as they can. They're taking grain and acres out of the CRP, and they're basically restricting some farm programs, for example, crop insurance and some of the others, to help give a safety net out of the marketplace. So a bigger ethanol demand is needed to help stabilize a very stable farm economy at the present time.
Any final word of advice before I let you go?
Have a profitable day.
I will. You too. That's Paul Cooley. He's with ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Wednesday afternoon. If you have not yet visited our website, please do that. It's at willag.org, WILLAG.org. There you'll find all kinds of ways to listen to our agricultural programming, and they're posted there not long after we air them on the radio stations for the very first time, in their entirety, in fact. And you can sign up for our weekend newsletter. And one other thing, we're about a couple hundred thousand dollars short of our goal financially for collections of financial money from you. And if you could pledge your support to this program, it would be helpful by June the 30th at willag.org. It's important to have it all in the bank. This is a cooperative effort between University of Illinois, the Illinois Public Media Radio Stations, your commercial radio station, University of Illinois Extension, and you, and you're one of the financial links. Please do give if you can. Visit willag.org. Look up at the right-hand side of the page, and please do pledge your financial support. Now here's Dave with an update of today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, a new standard reinsurance agreement between the crop industry and USDA will impact crop insurance agents in five Corn Belt states the greatest. Five states classified as the Corn Belt, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska, will take the largest cuts under the new standard reinsurance agreement, with about a 30% reduction in administrative and operating compensation and underwriting gains. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says that USDA plans to do what it can to make ethanol a national industry by investing in infrastructure and technology. In a couple of days, Vilsack says that USDA is set to release a report to offer a roadmap on how to build on the success of corn-based ethanol and to meet the goals of the Federal Renewable Fuels Standard. The RFS mandates the use of 36 billion gallons of ethanol and other biofuels by 2022. For starters, Vilsack says he believes that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will approve the use of E15 in at least some vehicles yet this year. The CME Group will launch intra-commodity options on the spreads between corn and wheat futures starting July 25th. The options will trade on CME's electronic Globex platform and in the exchange's open outcry pits. CME officials say the new listings will allow customers to trade spreads in the form of an option, helping to manage their risk at a fixed cost. The International Energy Agency today says that world oil demand will rise more than previously forecast, and supply will also grow. The agency raised its oil demand growth outlook to an average 1.4%, or 1.2 million barrels per day for every year to 2015, on the back of robust demand from emerging markets, taking the total volume to 91.9 million barrels in 2015. The IEA says that global oil supply will rise by 300,000 barrels a year to 96.5 million barrels by 2015. Rabobank says that global wheat production in 2010-2011 is expected to fall 3% on year to 660 million metric tons due to adverse weather conditions in the Northern Hemisphere. Rabobank says that Canada is now forecast to produce 20.5 million tons of wheat, significantly lower than the USDA estimate of 24.5 million tons due to excessive rain, which hampered plantings. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. A couple of programming notes to pass along. Many of you were very, very interested in the wind industry interview we did with the folks at the National Research Energy Lab. That's located in Denver, Colorado. We'll put that one back on this Friday at 2:36. So if you want to know a bit more about wind energy, or to just listen to that again, we'll put it back into the programming content on this coming Friday. And tomorrow, an interesting conversation about the Gulf Coast and what we here in the Midwest might be able to do to help out. In fact, LSU's Ag Center and Extension in Louisiana is working with the University of Illinois to put local shrimpers there in contact with consumers here. And it should work in a really efficient way through a website developed by U of I Extension called Market Maker. We'll air that program tomorrow right here on the Closing Market Report during the Farming World. Now up next, let's talk a bit more about the Gulf Coast. This time we'll talk about the hypoxia zone. It's been blamed on pollutants from right here in Middle America, but the size of the zone changes constantly. And it's a pretty poor indicator, as you'll hear, of the nutrient load that's coming from the Mississippi Valley. The hypoxia zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River changes in size hour by hour, says George Zappar. He's an extension water quality specialist at the University of Illinois and has been on the meeting circuit talking to farmers and fertilizer dealers about the plant nutrients they apply. A fertilizer runoff from farm fields and golf courses and lawns in the Mississippi and the Ohio River Valley Basin are blamed for the size of the zone. Yet Zappar says the size of the zone changes so often that it's not really a good measurement of fertilizer management.
If we have a hurricane, for example, we'll go through and mix up the zone of hypoxia and basically aerate that water, and it goes away, even though the culprit, the cause of that, may still be there, and it's just a really difficult way to measure if we're seeing improvements or changes in water quality, because it is such a grab sample, basically, of a very dynamic number.
The size of the zone in square miles is a very easy number for people to understand. Is it bigger or smaller? And then correspondingly, who is to praise or to blame? The problem is that number changes too often to be relevant.
For example, this last year when they measured the zone of hypoxia, it was a lot smaller than they had expected. It was off by about 5,000 square miles, and that was the same team that had predicted the zone of hypoxia just a month earlier. And so it just gives you some idea of just how variable this number is, and I think we're probably better served to look at more local water quality impacts and look at changes in terms of best management practices, reductions in loading to streams and rivers, because I think we can monitor those a little bit more closely, and certainly we can have more confidence that they're reflecting what's going on.
What has been happening, as indicated by a U.S. EPA Science Advisory Board, says Zappar, is that farmers have been doing a pretty good job of not over-applying nutrients. There are still things that need to be done to make those nutrients stay put all of the time, but their cost generally keeps producers from over-applying. Well, the Science Advisory Board recommended the following management options in 2007. The promotion of perennial crops for biofuels. Variable rate application of fertilizers or some other in-field efficiencies. Wetland construction. Tighter nitrogen and phosphorus limits on municipal and private industrial point sources, not farms, and the construction of targeted conservation buffers. In the end, promoting local water quality improves the flow downstream. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Time to check the cash grain market. Scott Butcher of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana, is on the phone line with us. Good afternoon to you, Scott. Thanks for filling in for Matt Blaisdell.
Glad to be here, Todd.
Tell me about the ethanol side of your site to begin with. You making money there and the margin's still pretty decent?
Yeah, we are. The plant is running really well, and margins are staying fairly decent right now, so we're in good shape.
Now, last week, I suspect you got quite a little bit of corn in, but has that shut off?
Yeah, it has slowed down somewhat here in the last week with the board moving down the way it has. We've really had to resort to other methods to originate corn right now. We've got a lot of guys doing basis contracts and also looking at DP options, so anything to keep corn moving right now.
And you're keeping it moving. Does that mean you're still bringing it in from the bin?
Yeah. A lot of, it seems like there's a lot of corn left on the farm in our area, both commercially and on the farm. So, we are seeing, decent movement when the market allows.
And what's the basis like?
Our basis right now would be option price to July.
Okay, and then tell me about basis for soybeans. That's been very good because of short supplies in the area.
Yeah, it has. In our area, the processor market is very strong. The local processors are, anywhere from 40 to 50 over right now for soybeans, depending on which option month they are buying off of.
And then turn your attention further out. What do you see happening in the marketplace as we head into the latter part of July, August, and then into early harvest in September?
Well, I think as we get into July and August, I think there's a lot of corn, just like I mentioned a minute ago, I think there's a lot of corn still out there that has to move somewhere before harvest. I think as we get, closer to harvest and we kind of get into a time period where everybody gets a better handle on what they have as far as a crop, there's a lot of corn that still has to move. So I'm afraid basis in July and August could continue to weaken as we get through the summer here. It seems like, there's going to be a lot of people holding on to the last minute.
And you see the opposite effect happening in beans?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think bean supplies are very scarce in our area. I don't think that's going to change. We're in the area that we're in. We have a lot of processor movement, early. And then as we get into the summertime, the beans just aren't there anymore. So we see, pretty good basis swing as we go through the summer.
And Scott, what are your bids for the dime?
Right now for cash corn, we are $3.51. Cash soybeans, $9.70.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Scott Butcher is with the Anderson's Climbers facility. That's located in Delphi, Indiana. Somebody from that office joins us here on the Closing Mark Report each and every Wednesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear what Scott had to say again, you can always do that at willag.org. That's our website. The address again is willag.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the pre-opening and closing mark reports to the opening market report and midday report, including Commodity Week. That's our weekend look at what's happening in the marketplace. It's all posted there not long after we put it up on the radio stations for you to listen to. You can come in back in the evening and hear everything again if you'd like. It's all for free at willag.org. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, U.S. regulators revised down the estimated cost of cleaning up the hundreds of bank failures yesterday, saying the industry is seeing better earnings and a greater ability to raise capital. The staff of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said it now believes bank failures will cost the industry-backed insurance fund $60 billion between 2010 and 2014. Previously, the FDIC had estimated a cost of $60 billion over 2010 to 2013. The FDIC staff warned, however, that spreading economic effects of the Gulf Coast oil spill and the European debt crisis could prompt the FDIC to raise its latest estimate. Auto Group AAA says that the number of Americans that plan to travel during the 4th of July holiday weekend will jump 17.1% from 2009 levels. AAA says about 34.9 million travelers will take a trip at least 50 miles away from home, up sharply from 29.8 million last year. The number traveling by air is expected to increase by 8.2%. And the European Union formally requested in a letter today that the world's largest economies explore the introduction of a global tax on financial transactions. Writing to the G20 before a summit in Toronto on June 26th, the president of the EU Council says that the world needs a level playing field on bank levies and transaction taxes. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City is with us to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Hi, Drew. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
We sure like the rain to stop here at some point. You think you can manage to pull that off?
I can pull that off, but always be careful what you ask for. You always know that there's trouble around the corner when you start talking like that. There is still some showers and thunderstorms, or I guess are the right word. There are some showers and thunderstorms that are going to be moving across the region over the next couple of days. In fact, we've got another good chance for severe weather again tonight, or this afternoon tonight, across a part of the northern Midwest. In fact, all the Midwest will be somewhat at risk, but the highest risk is in the north. But it looks like we'll see some additional rain occur across a fair amount of the region over this next few days. The precipitation potential is pretty good. I don't think there's anybody that's going to necessarily be missed. But with that said, the amounts that occur in the lower parts of the region will probably be a little more erratic, and there will be some areas that get a very little amount of rain, and net drying will likely continue to occur in some of those areas. Some of that region is drying out a little bit at the moment. It's certainly southern Missouri. There's a few spots in far southern Illinois and down into the Delta, of course, that are still quite dry. We are going to see this wave of rain come and go fairly quickly. There'll be another one that comes and goes over the weekend, and then we'll run out of gas. And I think most of the precipitation will cease or at least become mostly insignificant as we go through the majority of next week. Now, there will be a few showers. Don't call me up and tell me otherwise, but the showers that do occur next week will be spotty. They'll be brief and light and probably producing two or three tenths of an inch of moisture at a time. Locally, a strong storm might produce 5 or 6 tenths of an inch, but they won't be very common, and we will see a firming of the soil and a drying of the excessive moisture areas finally. And so some of this river and stream flooding that we're dealing with out there will start to ease up next week. I don't expect anybody to be excessively dry at all in the first 7 days of the forecast, and that's mainly because it rains additionally over the weekend. Even in the second week of July, we may still have a drying bias, but we'll have so much subsoil moisture that this corn crop will just continue to rock and roll. And we'll keep an eye on things, though, later in July and in August, because we could very well run into some drier weather. I still believe at the end of the growing season, August and September, we'll have a drier bias.
So let's talk about that near term, relatively speaking. If we get out into the first week and second week of July there, we're a little drier, but we have a lot of soil moisture. Let's say we've got enough to get through the process of tasseling and shooting silks, and we get through some of that process. We'd be fearful only of one thing at that point, and heat. If it gets really hot, can we stay away from the really warm temperatures too?
I think that we can probably do that fairly well, at least in the month of July, and that should be all that we really need. When we get into August, I think we'll see more warmth of significance, and especially towards the latter part of the month. I certainly don't want to imply it's not going to be warm at all. I think that we will we'll continue to do what we've been doing here, bouncing back and forth and kind of staying away from the extremes. That should be the rule pretty much through the month of July. But when we get a little later in the season and we do start to firm up the soil a little bit and lower the humidity, I think the potential for hotter temperatures will be pretty good. So my concern continues to be focused more on the late corn crop and more likely the soybean crop for possible issues later down the road.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Stay with us if you can. For the Farming World, I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Rocky Lundy. He's the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council and based in Great Falls, Montana. Mr. Lundy, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. We're really appreciative of having you with us.
Thank you, Todd. Pleasure to be here.
Well, the mint industry, we know that Indiana, at one time, and I don't know whether it still is or not, used to be a great place to raise mint in the United States, and one of the primary mint-producing states, number one, I think, not only in the nation, but on the planet. Why don't you tell me about the industry today?
Well, it's most people aren't aware that the peppermint and spearmint flavors that they're familiar with are actually one of the few remaining natural flavors. You know, it's most of the flavors nowadays are all synthetic. But mint is still grown as a plant, harvested and steam distilled on the farm. And the oil, which is very concentrated, is extracted on the farm, put in the barrels, and sold eventually to companies such as William Wrigley Jr. or for chewing gum, or Colgate Palmolive for toothpaste. An interesting note would be between those two products, that those two products are responsible for 90% of purchasing 90% of the mint that's grown in the country. And it's really one of the true American heritages. And what I mean by that is mint roots. It's a sterile plant. The commercial mint plant is. It's sterile. It doesn't produce seeds, so it needs to be vegetatively propagated, much like strawberries, which has its advantages but has its disadvantages. Well, when the early settlers came over to this country, they had their mint roots from England. They had their mint roots with them. And when they first started colonizing, they would plant mint in the garden. And back in those days, it was used both in the kitchen for cooking and also, say, for medicinal purposes, which today there are documented studies about its beneficial effects on digestion. You know, the old tale of an after-dinner mint, well, it really does stimulate digestive enzymes in a person's stomach. And it started, like I'm saying, in Massachusetts, and Americans, farmers, were really the pioneers of it. What I mean by that is one person, history really doesn't, it's a little vague in there, but decided somewhere along the line to put the mint hay in, say, an old metal wash tub full of water, put a fire under it and boil it. Well, then the mint oil, being lighter than water, floated to the top. He skimmed it off and he had a new product to go peddle into the big city. And then, you know, in the 1880s or so, chewing gum was invented, and they added that for flavor, and on and on and on. But then it migrated, say, from Massachusetts towards the Midwest, in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. And to this day, there's very few acres in Michigan, even though there's, I would say there's still six growers, mint growers up there, around St. John's area, the Lansing area. And in fact, there's an old town named Mentha, which means, that's the genus of the mint plant. And there was an actual mint plantation 100 years ago in Mentha, Michigan. Today, there's no mint grown in Ohio anymore. There, as you mentioned, Indiana was the center of mint production up until, say, 1930, 1940. They still have the big mint festival at North Judson, which is always fun to attend. But one problem with growing mint that is traced back. It was identified in 1940 by a plant pathologist from Michigan State as a disease called verticillium wilt. And we have a strain specific to mint that once it's in the soil and in the fields, it stays there forever. I know of growers that the term's called wilted out, which means that the levels of verticillium got so high that they could not produce a crop. That they hadn't grown mint in that field for 50 years, and they tried to grow it and still could not grow it. The vert wilt was still there. And that's really the reason it kept migrating, even from, there was no reason for it to really move out of Massachusetts, but and back then, they didn't know what it was. They actually thought that the mint plant was, you know, absorbing all the nutrients from the, you know, kind of wearing the soil out, and that's why it wouldn't grow anymore. But it was verticillium wilt, which, you know, is a disease in many crops, tomatoes, potatoes. Let me try to tie that back into the mint plant being a sterile clone. Is we have no conventional breeding tools to say, like some crops have, they've gone back to old relatives, and there's many, many old mint plants relatives out there that are verticillium wilt resistant, but since it's a sterile plant, we can't crossbreed back to improve any of the varieties. So it kept migrating, and eventually Indiana's number one status was replaced by Oregon on the West Coast. And I'm saying that that's why it kept migrating towards the West, was the verticillium wilt. And through the research of state land grant universities over the last 30 or 40 years, including Purdue and Michigan State and others you're familiar with, we've learned how to manage verticillium wilt simply by always trying to plant certified clean rootstock and then, you know, rotate to another crop that is not susceptible to wilt. Rotate out probably every 3 years, and that seems to help the growers stay in business, although the yields do continue to drop, you know, from the vert wilt. But I know that's a long answer to your question, but...
Oh, that's okay. Can you tell me, I think I read that the common way to market mint was in a 55-gallon drum, the mint oil, correct?
Correct, a 55-gallon galvanized steel drum. And to maybe put it in perspective to the listeners about how concentrated mint oil is, that one drum... or 55 gallons of mint oil, flavors 3.2 million sticks of chewing gum.
And how many acres of mint would you have in order to distill that much oil?
In Indiana, they're probably averaging about four. It's sold in pounds on the interstate market on pounds, which is about a pint. And my feelings on why it was developed like that is back in, say, 100 years ago, if it was sold, say, by the gallon or something, there's always somebody, you know, that's a little bit deceitful that could adulterate that and say, water it down or add methyl alcohol or something if you just sold it by that. So we know what a specific pound, the volume of a specific pound of mint oil is based on its specific gravity, so it keeps it true. So anyway, a pound is about a pint, and in Indiana, say, they would be yielding about 40 pounds per acre. And I don't have my calculator handy. The viewers have to do the math themselves to figure out how many acres if you're getting, say, 40 pints to the acre, or maybe you can do that while we're talking.
I can. I've got a calculator in front of me, so the calculation says, how do I do the calculation? Because I don't know how much the weight is for a gallon.
Well, let's see. A pint is 16 ounces, and there's 128 ounces in a gallon.
Right.
So how many pints in a gallon then? We have eight. Is that eight?
Mm-hmm.
And the growers are getting, let's say 45 pounds, which is 45 pints. Same thing as 45 pints.
Right.
So 45 pints divided by 8 will give us gallons.
Right.
What's that come out to?
5.6.
Five. So let's say 100, we're looking at 100 acres in Indiana to fill one of those 55-gallon drums. And, the reason I probably didn't know that off the top of my head is because the yields do vary. And, in fact, I mentioned Oregon. Oregon average yield is twice that. It's like around 90. And the reasons for that is production. I mean, it's all economics. The production cost of an Indiana grower are so much less. They would be more than half less than, say, that of Oregon, simply because, a lot of land in Indiana and other places is on a rental. Absentee landowners, they rent them out. Also, most of the acres in Indiana that grow mint and other crops are not supplemental irrigation water, pumping from groundwater wells and spring and having hired men out there to change pipes and whatnot. Whereas out in the far west, as we call it, Oregon, Washington, it's all under irrigation, under sprinkler. There are some flood irrigation fields in some areas, but also the pests involved with production. In Indiana, there are hardly ever any insect pests. It's just the way it is. Once in a while, they'll have a flare-up of something, but usually not so. And the big problem with mint anywhere is weeds. There's reasons for that. But back to the insect pest, you take Oregon, they've got every pest known. And mint is very unique in that there's at least three or four insect-type pests that are just specific to mint, and they're very devastating once you get them. Mint root borer is one. Mint flea beetle is another one. That it's the only pest that attacks is mint. But out in Oregon, there are so many voracious insect-type pests that just over the years from all the different crops that, say, are grown in the Willamette Valley, have built up in the populations and attack crops. So they really have their work cut out for them as far as pest control in those areas. In some areas of Oregon production, the mint really won't go dormant, and that means the weeds don't go dormant either. I know mint growers that in around Christmas time might be out spraying the fields for, winter annuals and biennials. So the production cost, even though it sounds like, oh, geez, their yields are double, the economics still favor, production in Indiana and the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this afternoon with Rocky Lundy. He is the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He's in Great Falls, Montana. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Pecan Sandy Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1857, William Kelly is issued a U.S. patent for manufacturing of iron and steel. He invented the air blast method of forming steel from iron. His initial goal was to reduce the amount of fuel required for iron and steel making because of the immense amount of timber required to make the charcoal. But Kelly saw little financial gain from his idea. He went bankrupt in 1857 and was forced to sell his patent. In 1868, Christopher Nathan Scholes of Wisconsin patented a mechanical writing machine called a typewriter. It was as large as a desk made of black walnut and had black and white keys. He signed a deal with the Remington Arms Company for its manufacture in 1873. It was Remington who turned it into a more practical machine. In 1937, Nicholas Shackleton was born, an English geologist. He helped identify carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas by demonstrating that the fall of the ice ages was linked to decreases in atmospheric carbon dioxide. He also warned that excessive emissions of carbon dioxide could lead to global warming. By the way, during his lifetime, he amassed the world's largest collection of clarinets. And in 1982, a record low temperature of minus 117 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded at the South Pole. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we've been talking with Rocky Lundy, the Executive Director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He's in Great Falls, Montana. Let's see. When we finished up, we were discussing production costs. Let's talk about what that 55-gallon drum of mint might be worth. I suppose quite a little bit of money.
Yeah, Todd, if you got your calculator, take 55. I'll just do an average, say $20 a pound. The 55, it's like a checking account.
It's about $10,000, if I remember correctly, from the press releases.
Yes, and in fact, there's stories I believe it was in the mid-80s, where Mother Nature was not kind to the growers in the Midwest in particular, and with the drought situation. So the prices of mint oil just went through the roof. I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars a pound. And there were stories of growers that actually made their deliveries, you know, in the farm truck with the barrels on there, and they had a car of armed guards in front of the truck, in the back of the truck, just to make sure. And it is money in like a checking account. Back in the old days, things have changed as far as markets. A grower could store that oil. I mean, it's good for 10 or 20 years. He could store it in the shed and kind of wait until the market prices, you know, depending on time of year and stuff, got higher. And if he didn't need the money, he could hold it and sell it then. But that spot market is kind of gone nowadays, and much like other crops, you better have a contract signed with a buyer to grow mint now.
I've got two other questions I want to talk about, and of course we don't have that much time left, so if you can sort of be brief on these. One of them is a global marketplace. And what's happening with the import of mint, but let's take that up in just a moment. The other is I've heard some interesting stories about the on-farm contraptions, and I'll call them contraptions because I really haven't seen one, that are used for the harvest of mint. What's that look like, and how much work is it?
Well, Todd, in your neck of the woods, you'd get a kick out of visiting a mint farm during harvest and distillation. Basically, the process has stayed the same since it was first invented. It's the grower has to have a huge horse-powered steam boiler, you know, and they're big pieces of equipment, and some type of shed. And then the rest of it's all specialized equipment, too. The grower picks the windrow up, runs the hay through a chopper, much like a silage chopper, adjusts the teeth to where it's about an inch and a half size piece of hay through there. And it gets blown into what we call a tub. It's just a big semi-bed type looking thing, but it's a self-contained. It's got four walls. It can be the trap doors can be shut and sealed airtight. He drives that over there to the boiler then, or what we call the distillery, and hooks the steam lines. Steam's being generated in the boiler. Hooks the steam lines to the bottom of that tub. Steam comes through perforated pipes in the bottom and flows through that hay and then goes back to the distillery, where he will have condensers. It's kind of like an old moonshine still, and the process is still the same. And then the steam, the coils are surrounded by cold water, which condenses it back into a liquid. Then it goes from there into a receiving can, they call it, and basically physics takes over, and oil, being lighter than water, floats to the top. He skims the oil off into those 55-gallon barrels, and he continues to do that. And a lot of those operations, they'll run at 24 hours a day. It's pretty intense kind of thing, and there again, the initial capital cost, a grower just doesn't get into it in the short run. It's like he doesn't just plant it 1 year and decide he doesn't like to grow mint, because he's putting up a lot of capital, $1 million in equipment and distillery to grow mint. So it's not for the weak-hearted. There's a lot of high management involved, as I mentioned, especially with herbicides and weed control. Mint is not a deep-rooted crop. 90% of the roots are in the top foot. It loves water, so the weeds get a jump on it. It emerges late and just outcompete it, so yeah. They're constantly fighting weeds.
We have about a minute and a half left. Speaking of constantly fighting, it appears that the mint industry is in a battle to hold on to domestic production.
Yeah, I'll throw some numbers at you. Between, 1997 and 2007, the number of farms went from close to 1,000 to 350. And the U.S., we one time had about 75% of the world's market of mint oil. Everybody loves our mint oil. They still do. But, the price drives everything. And then in the mid-90s, India and China got into the mint game, and that was responsible for that reduction in farms. Our total production, say, in 1996 was 12 million pounds. Now we're at, I would say, I'd be a little bit liberal saying 9 million pounds. And it's due to the foreign competition. You know, they're not driving John Deere tractors over there, and it's hard to compete.
Mm-hmm. Rocky Lundy is the executive director of the Mint Industry Research Council. He came to us today from his head office there in Great Falls, Montana. This is The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.